This episode of the CE Drive podcast is brought to you by Business Career College. Business Career College is a leading provider of financial services education, including the life insurance licensing program, the entire set of courses leading to the CFP certification, which is actually where I spend most of my time teaching and where I have met many of the participants in these podcasts. We also provide continuing education credits, live classroom and webinar instruction in support of the Elder Planning Counselor designation, and a few other odds and ends in support of folks in the financial services industry. You can find the full catalog of course offerings at www.businesscareercollege.com. Hi, this is Jason Watt. Welcome back to the CE Drive podcast. This episode is approved for one practice management credit by the Financial Planning Standards Council. It's not a financial planning credit. You can only have up to 5 practice management credits for the year in order to meet your requirements. This course will be good for life credits in Alberta, A&S credits in Alberta. It will be approved in Manitoba as well. For other jurisdictions, it's a little bit different than what we've seen with the prior episodes. It'll be good in Ontario, of course. That's up to your discretion. Ontario is a self-approval jurisdiction. I believe it's probably not good for the rules in Saskatchewan and British Columbia as they were written, so obviously you're welcome to listen to the podcast, but if you're getting credits for either BC or Saskatchewan insurance licensing, then this is probably not going to help you. It'll still be good for your financial planning credits, and we will keep episodes like this to a minimum. Episodes that deal more with practice management will deal more with financial planning episodes, or sorry, financial planning discussions in future episodes. The color for today's episode is gray. The color is gray. In the next set of interviews, we're going to hear Ian and Kent talk about some education choices that they have made that has helped their respective careers and how they made those choices. I wanted to take a few minutes before we get into the interviews with Ian and Kent to talk about some of the things that I think are worth considering when you look at whether or not to take a particular education program. I spend most of my time in the CFP designation program, helping students to attain that designation. And obviously, I'm quite partial to the CFP. Pretty much any time somebody comes to me and says, hey, Jason, should I do my CFP? My answer is yes. However, I do qualify that answer. I think there's an optimal time to do it. I think generally, for most people, it doesn't make sense to do it in the first couple of years in the business, especially if you're working in a sort of eat what you kill model in that first couple of years. You have to go and find clients. You have to build a business. Now, if you're working in a salaried position, if you have a boss who will let you take courses and still pay you for it, then, hey, go for it. Get that CFP knocked out early. Of course, you can do all the education early, but you still need to be in the business 3 years to carry the actual CFP. Now, other than CFP, we can look at any other education program, any other course of study here. And I think what is missing sometimes is a degree of intentionality. I think it's worth exploring whether or not a program will actually help us out in terms of our careers, in terms of how we deal with clients. Some of the things that I think are worth exploring. First off, in general, what will this designation do for me? I hear people ask this question all the time. I actually had a conversation about this very thing earlier today. Unfortunately, that was a discussion after somebody had accomplished that designation and carried it for a number of years. I think it's better to ask that question in advance. How will this actually help my business out? How will this help my clients? Will this give me increased confidence? Some of those types of questions would be worth exploring. Now, I think sometimes in this business, we get a little bit, maybe, I don't know if we're hungry for some alphabet soup or whatever the case is, but I think sometimes we say, I only want to do education if it brings me a designation. And I think that can be a mistake. I think sometimes we have to look at it and say, look, I just want to learn something. And I'm going to go and I'm going to take a course on that particular topic, and I don't need a designation. If I just go and learn the subject material, I can still bring that back to my clients and be of additional service to my clients. Not everything has to lead to a designation. So if you have a topic you want to learn, there may or may not be a designation out there to support it. If there's not, hey, go take the training anyways. One of the things that I've been impressed with, and actually I will compliment Ian, who's one of the subjects on this podcast in particular, is I know Ian has gone to some training. He wanted to learn more tax stuff. And he went to a training session put on by actually somebody who trains accountants. He said, I'm going to go and I'm going to do an annual tax update. He actually chose to do a tax update with the good folks from Video Tax News. That's another Edmonton-based firm here with Joe Devaney and Caitlin Butler. And he covered off taxes to an extent that made him more capable. And it didn't get him any designation or anything like that. It was just a couple days learning about tax. Now, if you are going to pursue a designation or a certification or a charter, whatever the appropriate name is, a 3 or 4 letter acronym that's going to go behind your name, there are some things that I think are worth exploring before you pursue that designation. One of the things that can cause additional heartache would be any additional continuing education credit requirements. What do you have right now for continuing education credits? Do you find that you have more than enough opportunity to get those continuing ed credits? If you take an additional program, might that additional program give you additional CE credit requirements, and might that make your life a little bit more difficult or potentially more expensive? That's one that I think sometimes people don't look into until they have finished the program. What's the annual cost to maintain it? Is there some sort of subscription or renewal fee to pay? Do you have to answer to some sort of a body every year as far as what you've done with the designation? Is there any sort of annual requirement that you're going to have to meet in terms of either finance or administration? One of the things that I think is a real win with some programs, and there are a couple of programs out there that are notable for this. Those of you that listened to the last interview heard Jeff talk about the CFDS designation, the Chartered Financial Divorce Specialist designation. And one of the benefits of that particular program is it does open up community that you can access. And Jeff had talked about that a little bit. In this interview, you'll actually hear Kent talk about that a little bit as well with the Family Enterprise Advisor. I've heard that as well with the TEP designation, the Trust and Estate Practitioner designation, that opens up doors to the STEP meetings, which can be a good place to meet some good quality people. What about the actual content? You're going to learn something, hopefully, and it would be great if learning something was actually an enjoyable experience, that you could actually work through the program in a way that keeps you engaged and doesn't feel like a grind to do it. What about instruction that's associated with the program? Is it just a textbook? Does somebody just send you a textbook? Or are there some sort of assignments or quizzes? Is there maybe some live classroom support available or forums where you can interact with instructors? Is there anything in the way of additional support? A lot of the courses that we do at Business Career College have a robust library of YouTube videos behind them. And I know a lot of people really like those YouTube videos. That's a little bit of a different learning model than maybe what we've been accustomed to in the past. What about the actual body that supports the designation? One of the items to consider here is, do they actually have some sort of an independent relationship from the designation itself or from the providers of education for the designation? Of course, this is something that the CFP designation is well known for. You really have a couple of layers behind the CFP that mean that the Financial Planning Standards Council, or soon to be Financial Planning Canada, they are not alone in offering this. They take care of the standard setting for it, but the bulk of the education is delivered by other entities, and then they have a rigorous exam standard on top of that. And then also, if we're on the topic of CFP, it's worth exploring whether the program is recognized internationally. And you may not have any ambitions to work in other countries, but where you have a program that's recognized internationally, it can often give that additional benefit of some assurance that the program will stick around. And we should be looking at that. Will the entity that's offering the program be around? Do they have a good long history? I have this concern sometimes with some of the for-profit providers that have their own in-house designation program. Will that for-profit provider be around forever and ever? Or if they get bought or something like that, will that program still maintain its same level of quality? What about any ethics requirement associated with the program? Will you have an additional ethics requirement that you'll have to meet? That may be a good thing. You may actually seek out that ethics requirement. I know this is something that sometimes happens with the registered financial planner, the RFP program, that some people take that program just because of the ethics requirements associated with it. It may be, though, that the ethics requirement associated with the program is a limiting factor for you. We're actually seeing this a little bit right now in the United States with the introduction of fiduciary obligations, where some firms won't allow their agents or their advisors to take a program where there's a fiduciary component to it, because fiduciary doesn't tend to fit really well into proprietary or sort of closed agency models. Not to say that it can't work, but it can be a little bit of a challenge. Will your clients understand what you've done? You go and take this program. Is it something that your clients will see some value in? Will your clients attach to it somehow? I think it's worth considering whether or not this will actually help out your clients. And will it actually help you to provide better service to your clients? Is there any efficiencies to be achieved with this program? I know this is something that people used to do quite a bit. I don't see it so much anymore, but I know people have in the past taken their CFP core curriculum sort of one course at a time, 1 year at a time, in order to get their, let's say, insurance continuing education requirements done. So they'd spread that out over 4 years and they will have met their CE requirements then for their insurance license, while at the same time finishing out the CFP core curriculum. I'm not a big fan of that approach. I think that the problem there is it doesn't leave you very well prepared to actually write the exams you have to write to finish out your CFP, and it doesn't, I think, create the kind of discipline you need to get through the capstone course, which of course is going away in 2020, but as of right now is part of the requirement and is an awful lot of work. And not to say there'll be less work after 2020. I don't think we should get too optimistic about that. What about examinations? Is there any sort of exam associated with the program? And if there is an exam associated with it, is it something you have to go somewhere to write? Do you have to travel to write the exam? And this would be especially a concern if you happen to be in a more remote area. If you're in Whitehorse, for example, you'll probably not find that many education providers that can accommodate, at least not easily, an exam in Whitehorse. So you might want to look at that. How often is the exam offered? What's the cost for the exam? I'll pick on the Chartered Financial Analyst Charter here, the CFA Charter, as an example of this. The CFA Charter is a notoriously expensive exam, not available in very many centers, and really has a fairly hefty administrative requirement to write it. You have to typically travel to write it, and it becomes a whole day or almost 2 days of your life to write one of those exams. And it's very expensive, if I didn't mention that already. What about student support? Are you going to get help from the actual entity that offers the program? Not so much on the learning side, but more on the administration side. If you lose a password, if you can't log in, if you can't find something on a website, if you're looking for proof of completion or receipts or any of those routine administrative matters, is there somebody that's actually going to be able to help you? And are they going to be able to help you in a fairly timely fashion? I know some places, I'll give Advocus credit here. Advocus has a good 1-800 number, which is open not 24 hours, but about half the day. And that 1-800 number, generally, in my experience, provides pretty good service. This is something we've recently introduced. We have an online chat support where people 24 hours a day can click and get a friendly chat. That doesn't always get you immediate resolution to a problem, but at least you know your problem's been resolved. So those are some of the things I think are worth looking at. I know it's a long list of stuff, but some of the things I think are worth looking at when you're considering a program. And obviously, if you're looking at a more intensive program, you're going to do a little bit more digging. If it's a lighter program, you're probably not so concerned about it. Joining us today, we have Kent. Kent is a financial planner based in Edmonton.
He works in a securities firm and he is also insurance licensed. Thanks very much for joining us, Kent. I think the first thing we're going to launch into here is you recently completed the Family Enterprise Advisor designation, and I'm curious to hear a little bit about the thought process that went into selecting that education path.
Certainly. With the FEA program, it was introduced to it, and something that I'll say sounded quite interesting to me also, just from a perspective of working with some business owners and realizing that there's obviously the ties there between business and personal, and there's an awful lot of overlap, and how the family or families can affect these things. And so it more came from that side of it as opposed to the, call it the investment side. And looked at the course, it sounded very interesting. In taking it, I'll say it was very different than anything that I'd looked at before, and an awful lot more that focus on family, and which is something that I very much believe in, and it's how to make things work with families. And just because a family has money doesn't mean that they're have no problems. And usually the problems just sometimes end up bigger. The people who taught it, I mean, it was a quite a long program. It was basically your 2 or 3 days a month for a good part of a year. And then you do project work with a family. You find a family you can do some work with. And basically that project is getting them to the point of implementation. There isn't actually any implementation, but getting them to that. And then there is a couple of exams that you end up doing. But it was something that very different than I thought. And when I walked in, I, you know, a very diverse group of people from law to private enterprise to financial side and accounting. So there's quite a large group of people. And seeing their interest and the thing that we learned, I guess, was we're all coming at this from different points and different places. And so we do tend to think very differently. So one of the bigger things I took from this is understanding that collaboration and working with other people is going to make the family that much better off. And an analogy they used and I loved was that of a pit crew, where you think of any car race. Well, if you watch the pit crew and how quickly they can do things, and everyone knows exactly what their job is and how they do things, and they work so well together. And for most families and most enterprises out there, unfortunately, what ends up happening is you have different advisors working from different ideas or different places, and they don't necessarily speak. You want to see that multidisciplinary advising is one of the bigger things that they look at, where you know, the lawyer is talking to the accountant, who's talking to the financial advisor, and there's, you know, within the family, and you need someone to be quarterbacking all of this. And going back to that pit crew analogy, if you had the best tax lawyer out there, or if you had the best tax accountant out there, or the best whatever it happens to be, if they're doing things on their own in their own little silo, well, then it's not going to be as good as that team that understands how to work together. So that's something that just really stuck, and I look forward to working and finding that group and building it out.
There's so much there. I love that pit crew analogy. That's great. You obviously learned a lot from the course. Just talking about it, you can hear how much stuff you picked up. I'm curious about some of the logistics around taking the course. Was it something you had to travel for then, for those 2 or 3 days a month?
Yeah, they offer this in Calgary, Vancouver, and Toronto, I think are the three places now. And basically within our group, and I was doing it in Calgary, within our group, we had several people coming from Winnipeg, you know, so there is a couple of people from Edmonton, there were some people from Winnipeg, there were some people from Calgary. And then if you missed a day or a, you know, a couple of days, they would not let you had to make them up. Like you actually had to be in the class. Like, so if you missed a day, then you would have to go to Toronto or Vancouver or the next go around, like the next year, you would actually have to go and make it up. And so, yeah, it involves some travel and long days, really. I mean, like you're going from 8 till 4, and there's an awful lot of content that I'd never seen or thought of before. And so how to tie that in, I think it'll help with all of my business. Like, you know, just working with any family, you know, whether they have a business or not, you know, it'll help with those people because you just have a better understanding how you can work with people.
What about cost for the course, Ken? Can you give a rough idea of cost?
Expensive. If I remember right, it's between 10 and 15,000.
Sounds like good value for the money, though.
I think so. I mean, that's sort of the way I looked at it, is something that I did know of a couple other people who'd done the program, and they spoke very highly of it. And so it was more difficult paying it initially because you're paying this money up front. But I see that, well, I feel I'll get value out of it. You know, am I going to get someone to write a check and have me doing family advising? No, but it's, you can just better work with your clients.
I am curious about that. And that's a hefty commitment, both financially and as far as your time goes, the travel, the course load. What was happening in your business or what was happening with you personally that motivated you to take that course? There's, you know, lots of education opportunities out there. Is there something you can put a finger on where you say, this is why I did FEA, or was it more general than that?
Probably more general, but I mean, I did the CFP, you know, in the last few years, and that was a few years ago now, and I've sort of furthered along with more tying into business owners and some education that way with business owners, building up value in business, this type of thing. And then, of course, in realizing that, I mean, you're at a point where most businesses are run by families or by, you know, single owners and this type of thing. And there's an awful lot of businesses that I will say will not continue. They're just not, they're not built to. The owners don't take the time to make their business saleable. And you know, they sort of act as that hub where they're the, you know, everybody has to come to them, but that means the value of their business is pretty small. I mean, if they can't go out and take a 6-week vacation without, you know, business suffering, then they don't have a valuable business. And so the tying in the family enterprise, it seemed like a logical next step. And when I was looking at the content, it seemed to me that this was something that I just had no real training in. I certainly not from our, or I had not seen very little from our industry on that. And it just went far more in depth. And I look at the information that I have today, I'll be able to understand things better than I could before.
You hit a little too close to home there, Kent, with that comment about 6 weeks away. I don't think I could do 6 weeks away today. I know I can do three.
Well, and that's, you know, in looking at a business, that's part of it. You know, I mean, because if you can't do that, then to the new buyer, I mean, where's the value? Or what it does is it creates far more opportunities for buyers. I mean, we know certainly there's an awful lot more private equity out there. If you have a business that can run itself and is going to make X amount of money because they have so much recurring revenue and other types of things, well, then that's what that buyer wants to buy.
I do agree with that. I'm a big fan of John Warrilow's Built to Sell radio podcast, and he talks about that extensively. They're also a really good book to accompany it. The book is actually just called Automatic Customer. It's so good.
Yes, I very much, and I know John, and I very much and use their information as well as another group that I work with called Business Enterprise Institute out of Colorado, and there's some very good information out that way.
I'll look at them too. I wasn't aware of Business Enterprise Institute. That's good to know. Now, you talked about building out your centers of influence here, Kent. Is that something that you've started down the path of yet? You know, talking to those lawyers and accountants and business valuators and whoever else you might want to add to your, call it, pit crew?
There's some people who I've spoken to, and I look to, at this point in time, I mean, do I have a set group of people where we're going to do this? No, we've got, there is a couple of us sort of right now that we're sort of thinking along this line. One group that's sort of already been sort of there that we're having discussions whether I can join them, so to speak, and make sure that there's a fit there. But it's finding that right group of people that, number one, you fit with, and you know, because there does have to be an awful lot of, you know, confidence in each other and understanding each other's business. And I will tie that back in the family enterprise, because that's when you know someone has taken that course, you know, it gives you a couple of bits of information. One, family is important to them. Two, it also, you know that they have a certain level of knowledge because they've had to take it. In order to have that designation, they have a certain level of knowledge. And it is, like I say, to me, it's a very different level of knowledge. So it's something that I will look for in seeing other advisors out there.
Especially with that rigorous education requirement, you know that nobody will have put in half an effort to get this thing done. That's really good. Now, I'm curious then about your clients. Your clients are accustomed to receiving, let's say, conventional financial advice from you. You know, talking about, I know you're not like a stock picker or whatever the case is, but your clients would be accustomed to talking about investments and insurance and maybe some cash flow management and retirement planning. Are they responding well in your conversations so far to talking about how their business actually operates?
Yes. I mean, with my clients, it's interesting sometimes I haven't even figured out some of the clients that, oh, they have this business, but I hadn't sort of realized, oh, well, this is how we can tie it in. And the bigger reason I think that I, you know, had done this initially was in building out my business, in making sure that I'm finding the right clients, being able to, you know, having this information in finding new potential clients as well, and being able to tie in their business and their personal, because in their life it is. If they're a small business owner, then it's 100% tied. Your personal time, you know, planning is very much tied to the business planning. Some people do that, you know, like even, but even like if you look at a business and say, well, you know, someone thinks, okay, maybe their business is worth $2 million. Or they think that it is. Well, is it worth $2 million or not? It's only really truly worth that if a person can get someone to write the check for it. But you can also have valuations done and this type of thing to do that. And then you can take the steps that you need to take to prove the value. You know, whether that's through recurring revenue or other types of thing, then to make sure you have that value there.
That makes a lot of sense, Ken. I think I see how you're going to be able to bring value to your clients and value to your practice by adding the Family Enterprise Advisor designation. Thanks very much for taking some time to talk about that.
No problem.
Okay, we just heard from Kent, and we heard in that interview, I think, that Kent did have a reason for pursuing that Family Enterprise Advisor designation. Sounds like it's really helped his business. He got what he was looking for out of it. I'd be interested to talk to Kent in a year or so and see how he feels then, see if he continues to get that value out of it. I certainly hope so. That's a fairly hefty price tag, although I am seeing that with some of these higher-end programs today where they have that hefty price tag attached. And that does, of course, attract somebody who is a little bit more committed to the program. You'll be able to get your continuing education credits by going to bccquiz.online. That's BCC as in Business Career College. bccquiz.online, and there's a little quiz you'll do there, just a few questions, and if you're already a subscriber, then it will issue you a certificate. If you're not already a subscriber, then you will have to sign up, and you'll be able to sign up there, and you'll be able to get your continuing education credits that way.
This episode of the CE Podcast is brought to you by Business Career College. Business Career College is a leading provider of financial services education, including the life insurance licensing program, the entire set of courses leading to the CFP certification, which is actually where I spend most of my time teaching and where I have met many of the participants in these podcasts. We also provide continuing education credits, live classroom and webinar instruction in support of the Elder Planning Counselor designation, and a few other odds and ends in support of folks in the financial services industry. You can find the full catalog of course offerings at www.businesscareercollege.com.
One other thing I did fail to mention at the beginning of the episode when I went through my list of things to consider with respect to your financial planning designations is that if you happen to be at an IROC firm, IROC does have some restrictions on the use of business titles and financial designations. There's an IROC notice 14-0073 from March of 2014, use of titles and financial designations, and it does lay out some criteria. It's not a prescriptive list, but it does lay out some criteria here. And really this says you can't use a designation unless it has a rigorous curriculum and examination process, that there are some experience requirements, that there's an emphasis on ethics, that there's a continuing education requirement, what's the method for determining whether you're current, is there a public complaint and disciplinary process, and then included in that set of criteria, is it issued by a reputable or accredited organization? It doesn't necessarily have to meet all of those criteria, but it does have to meet the bulk of those criteria. That would be sort of on the weight of those answers. That's where IROC says, yes, that's something you can put on your business card or signature block, or no, that's something that, fine, you get the education, but you can't necessarily put that on your signature block or on your business card. Let's now hear from Ian. Ian's going to talk about designations or education more broadly.
Thanks very much for joining us today, Ian. It's great to chat again.
Yeah, thanks for having me again.
So Ian is a financial planner based in Kingsville, Ontario, carries his life insurance and property and casualty insurance licenses, his investment license, and he's also completed the CIM designation. So obviously a lifelong learner, and I know you do lots of other learning as well. Ian, I know you send me periodically emails asking where can I learn more about this particular topic or that topic. And I really appreciate that. I think it's great that you don't give up on that learning. I'm hoping you can chat a little bit about how you choose the learning that you choose then.
Sure. My love for, it's really funny, when back when I was in high school and university, I hated math. So I never really thought I would end up down this road. But I decided fairly early on in my career that I was going to get my CFP. I went through business career college and completed off all the courses and, you know, passed my first exam, no problem, passed my second exam and got my CFP designation. And I guess the big thing that stood out to me was just how little or how much I didn't know prior to the CFP. So I had my life insurance license. I had my MFDA license. And I was taking in investments for clients, and I was doing life insurance and disability for clients. And it was very, very apparent after I finished my CFP that there was stuff that I just, out of sheer innocence, or maybe it was time in or just not enough reading, that just stuff that I just didn't know. So which shocked and kind of scared me. And that sent me down this path. And I think also just being young in the industry, I opened my own practice when I was 23 years old. I'm now 33. So, you know, we're talking 10 years down the road. And I had been in the industry prior to when I opened up my own practice at 23. But when you're young, there's always a little bit of this inferiority complex. So between being scared about the stuff that this unknown of things that I just didn't know and being young and just wanting to know more than everybody, it sent me down this path, this obsessive path of learning. So after that, I decided to go get my COU, which are life underwriter, my CHS designation, so the health specialist, also my CM, my FCSI, and my EPC designation. So it's funny because everyone who I type emails to people said, did the cat jump on the keyboard after your name? But what I found was just the information that was garnered through these was incredible. And I was just able to offer such better advice to my clients. And I was able to think outside the box from what I used to think. And I was able to see opportunities for the client, kind of like the last one we chatted about with the RDSP. We had a couple that, you know, went from the RESP for a disabled person over to the RDSP to fund a need. And I think I ended up choosing the bulk majority of my courses initially from what was offered at Business Career College and the ability to really hop off of that CFP designation, because, you know, you're able to get your CLU based on a lot of the course you've done with your CFP. And the same thing goes with your CHS designation. The CIM designation and the FCSI were specifically because I just felt like I had a weakness on my investment end of things. I really wanted to attack that and make sure that I had a full understanding on the investment side. And from there, I decided to really change how our practice operated here. And in terms of when I hired on my next advisor, Mitchell Shields, I implemented a training program that every single week I would sit down and begin teaching aspects of the CFP program to him. And now I've made it a mandate that any new advisor that I bring on has to complete their CFP, at least all the exams and everything. Yeah, I know there's always the work experience component, but has to complete their exam part by the 4-year mark. With being with me, and at least has to start after their first year, has to begin into the program. And so Mitch has now passed his first exam in the CFP, and he's working on his capstone right now, which is incredible. And then what we do is we have a WhatsApp chat group. So thankfully, we click on a lot of your resources and read them. We pass them back and forth in that WhatsApp chat group. Just recently hired another advisor, so she's in that chat group now. So we've made financial planning a topic in the office. Something that we chat about, something that we're obsessive nerds about. And I think there's something really, really neat in the industry going on where this is now, we're moving away from this being a sales job to this being a profession. And you see this with, you know, even books like Advice That Sticks. Advice That Sticks is about, you know, actually giving advice and having that client adhere to that advice, not about how to sell them something. Another book that that I found and Jason had passed on to me was, you know, Your Retirement Income Blueprint. Again, I felt that I had a weakness in the payout strategy for retirement planning. I think that there's a lot of focus specifically with advisors on how to accumulate funds for retirement, but there's very, very little focus on how do you pay this money out. So I found that book was incredible between the cash wedge strategy and trying to take things like LIRAs and, you know, at age 55, start moving them into the RRSP instead, just for creating some flexibility as opposed to having those mins and maxes on the LIRA. Talking about like tax credits and brackets and, you know, if you can fit it in within the first two tax brackets and paying at the order at which you should be paying out your assets. I found that book just incredible. Another thing that's really changed our practice is just how we take on clients now. So we did a lot of reading just through like Nick Murray. Also, there was another book that I had picked up called The Laws of Wealth by Dr. Daniel Crosby. And we've now made it a absolute mandate that in terms of if you're going to be a client of ours, you have to do a plan. So we actually will not take on any money without a plan. And the plan has to be in place, accepted, and a strategy has to be implemented prior to us actually bringing on assets under administration.
That really does sound like your practice has gone through a lot of change over the last decade or so. Do you find, Ian, that helps with client retention or referrals? Is it just that you feel better about the service that you're offering? Can you talk about some of the benefits and maybe some of the downsides as well of building out your practice in that manner?
Yeah, so initially, the very, very first thing that I noticed, and it was funny, I was chatting with a client here the other night. I feel a lot better about bringing money on. I remember when I first started, and I think the very first thing I brought on like $100,000, and we had just invested it. And I've since gone back to that client. We've developed a plan and everything else. But I remember walking out of that meeting and thinking, wow, that's amazing. I had someone entrusted me with $100,000 and I invested, and that felt great. But there was also this other side of me that said, what did I do for that? You know, what am I really offering the person? Because, I mean, they could really invest this anywhere in terms of are our investment options all that different from what else in the industry? No. I mean, like most investments, you know, you create a strategy and you see it through to the end. But the actual investments themselves, it's the same concept in a lot of ways. So I always had this weird irking feeling inside of me that I wasn't doing enough for the client. So once we flipped over to, you know, we will not bring on money without a plan, or we won't write a life insurance policy without a plan, or we won't write a disability insurance policy without a plan, I just found I felt so much better about myself. Number one, the client understood what was going on. Our retention and our at least adherence to the plan thus far has been just exponentially better. Prior to that, you know, we would set up, you know, a small investment, or we bring over some money. Inevitably, after a couple of years, it's, hey, can I take some money out of that thing? We're not seeing that now. In terms of the downside, there is a lot more time that's devoted to it. I mean, again, we're very, very lucky here because we have home and auto insurance. So the commission that's derived from that home and auto insurance allows us to spend a little bit more time on doing our retirement income plan or doing a life insurance or disability plan. So maybe if I didn't have that, this would become a bit more of an issue. But we've also just created this atmosphere here in the office of about the plan and about holistic planning and talking about it. It's just it's more fun now.
Now, you mentioned in your long list of educational resources that you've been using, you mentioned Dr. Moira Summers and Dr. Daniel Crosby's books, Advice That Sticks and The Laws of Wealth. And I'm wondering, Ian, based on these are both, I think, fairly solid behavioral finance books, based on having read those, are there specific things that you've been able to put in place as far as dealing with your clients? Is it more of a general approach to behavioral finance, or do you have actual tools that you use here in getting your clients to generate and follow a financial plan?
So one of the things that we have is we are now always having them sign off on the engagement letter. And part of that engagement letter talks a little bit about behavioral financing. But then I have a second page that goes along specifically on our investment side of things that talks about, because obviously anytime that you are investing in any type of equity product, there is volatility, and just helping clients understand what that volatility is in terms of there's day-to-day volatility, but there's also a long-term risk by not being invested in at least some sort of equities. So there's actually a sheet of paper that we have them fill out talking specifically about the ups and downs of equities on a yearly basis, also on a every 5 to 6 year basis, and then talking about the longevity of how long they're going to be investing, and you know, at what point in time are we pulling a substantial portion of this portfolio. I think by taking a lot more time to go through that and actually having them sign a piece of paper saying that we've gone over all of that, it at least allows us to go back to that. And during market downturns, I mean, luckily and unfortunately, you know, we've been in a huge bull market and we haven't had a major setback yet. I'm hoping that that's going to be a big player when we do have the major setback. I'd say, hey, we chatted about this. This is what's going on. Bit of an educational piece. The second thing that we did, and I'm hoping on the behavioral side of things, is that we've really moved away from the wrapped approach in terms of, you know, where we just have one mutual fund that has a whole bunch of mutual funds inside of them, the fund of fund account. And we're doing a lot more individual funds, so they can see specifically what a Canadian value fund is doing in comparison to a Canadian growth fund. And they can see that during different market segments, this one goes up and this one goes down and things like that.
That choice of individual funds versus a fund of funds or a portfolio fund or whatever seems contrary to one of the trends that I'm seeing amongst folks who have mutual funds as their primary investment vehicle. Do you find that having done the CIM and FCSI has helped you to be more comfortable with fund selection?
Perhaps. I think that it gave me a lot of knowledge. We have a very, very simple approach here. We're not trying to overcomplicate things. I mean, and that's one of the things that the Law of Wealth book by Daniel Crosby talks a lot about, is that, you know, the more complicated we try to make this investment experience, really the worse we're going to end up performing. But in terms of just helping people understand equities versus fixed income, and then also helping them understand, you know, Canada versus US versus global versus international versus small cap versus large cap, and, you know, growth versus value stocks, helping them understand that and how they interact, I'm speaking on behalf of my clients, but I think that it gives them a much better understanding of what the real world looks like. And it's not a sales pitch at that point in time, because you're just trying to teach them about how investments and how the market works. And when we come to those annual reviews, it is a lot easier to show the individual funds and how they're performing. But also on the flip side, it becomes a lot easier when you hit the retirement income strategy. And let's say you're trying to create a cash wedge strategy. You cannot create a cash wedge strategy with a fund of fund. It becomes next to impossible.
If you're going to do something like that, you definitely have to be a little bit more selective about how you're allocating assets. I find it curious how often I talk to people who are about your sort of vintage in the business, or even people who are longer in the business, who lament the fact that there has been just this steady sort of bull market and lack of a significant correction. We had a little bit earlier this year, but I think is already ancient history. How would you see yourself reacting, other than, you know, reminding your clients of what they committed to, when we do end up in the next correction or downturn or whatever we're calling it?
I try to chat a lot about just the past. And I know if we can, and during the initial setup conversation, talking about, you know, when markets have pulled back in the past, when we've experienced bear markets and what those were, talking about, you know, the tech stock bubble, and, you know, talking about, you know, the dot-com, the other recessions, the housing recession. Just, I try to touch on those, so that way when we do reach the next recession and we're sitting down, they at least have heard me chat about this before. I'm probably overly I'm very optimistic in terms of talking about long-term growth, but I'm very, very pessimistic in talking. I focus very, very heavily on what the downsides are. I mean, personally, and this doesn't mean for all my clients, but personally myself, I'm a very, very strong equities person. And I think there's just a large benefit in understanding what those recessions are and what those downturns are. And I'm hoping that it at least instills some confidence in the client that I've focused so much on that and knowing that long-term, historically, we're going to be okay.
It's the classic, you know, with a long enough holding period, every investment's going to pay off, right?
Right. I mean, it's funny. The other day, it's not just that. I mean, we finally just had our, as some other companies have pulled out of annuities, the company that we're dealing with has just put out a whole new line of annuities. And, you know, we just did a plan for a customer where we compared a balanced portfolio versus an annuity. And I think, and it's funny because Mitchell has been saying this, the way he's taking your CFP class that you kind of said on a number of occasions, I think annuities are underutilized. And after we ran this comparison, we kind of went, wow. You know, that's a solid product.
It is straight out of the CFP classes that I teach for sure. I honestly believe that annuities have gotten a bad rap and should have a place in most retirement portfolios. Not to say all of your money should be in annuities. That's, I think, crazy. But in the absence of defined benefit pensions, we need to find alternatives.
Absolutely. And for this particular client that came in that was, you know, very, very scared about capital preservation and really concerned about market ups and downs, I was very, very impressed at, because I haven't run an annuity quote in probably 9 years. I was impressed at what they look like now.
And we're in a classic low interest rate environment. It's not like annuities benefited from the, last Wednesday's interest rate hike hasn't suddenly bumped up annuity rates. That's not going to happen. That. So yeah, I agree with you. Yeah, and I find that
I think there's a big difference, Jason, when you start using planning and you start using the projection assumptions from the FPSC in your plans, as opposed to kind of what the fund companies that you deal with say, oh yeah, you throw say 7-8%. I mean, it's when you start using all my clients, the FPSC has no skin in the game. They're not trying to sell you an investment. They're just trying to use proper assumptions for planners so that way we can make accurate plans. And once I started using those, when you use those and you compare them against, say, an annuity rate, it's incredible how versatile an annuity can be.
Agreed. And I think you need to be looking at rates like that anyways when you're dealing with clients who are in or near retirement, just because, much as I know you said you're a big proponent of equities, that person probably can't be all in equities. Notwithstanding, I know there's some academic research out there that says you should be 100% equities through your whole life, and that ignores some realities, but you just can't take on that much risk. So yeah, I really appreciate you going through some of the thoughts you have around financial planning and lifelong learning. Ian, I think it's really great to see how you've taken what you've seen in the classroom and in books and turned it into what sounds like a really great experience for your clients. Thanks very much for sharing. Do you have any last minute thoughts, Ian?
You know what, if anyone is listening to this and is debating on getting their CFP, or they have their CFP and they're debating on their next designation, do it. At the end of the day, there's never been a point in time where I've spent money on a designation or a book or a learning seminar that is a well-researched one. I mean, listen, don't go just against any designation that I've walked away and gone, that wasn't worth it. I've always picked up on something, and there's always something that I've been able to add to my tool belt, or something where I could think about a client and go, I need to go back to that client because, hey, here's a different spin on what we'd originally looked at. And as professionals, I think that we should always be looking at our practice. And if you're the head of your practice, I strongly recommend implementing the CFP or nothing in your practice, because that's, as I said, when I employ new advisors, it's you're getting your CFP or you're not working here, because I think that it's the bare minimum you should have.
It's a practice I'm seeing more and more across the industry, Ian, and kudos to you for adopting it in a small firm. I see it in some larger firms for sure, but I know in a small firm you have all kinds of pressures. So yeah, kudos to you for adopting that practice. Thanks very much then, Ian, and have a wonderful day.
You as well, Jason. Thanks so much.
that interview, we heard Ian cover a lot of ground. One of the things that I wanted to highlight that Ian talked about, he referenced a few books in that interview, and I thought it was worth talking about the choice of books that we read, and I can actually reference some of the books that Ian talked about. So everything he talked about in there is excellent. The one that he mentioned, he didn't actually mention which book, but I believe he's talking about a book called Simple Wealth, Inevitable Wealth by Nick Murray. Nick is a well-known American financial planning sort of pundit or investment advice pundit. And again, that book is Simple Wealth, Inevitable Wealth. A lot of people swear by this book as sort of the gateway to good fundamental financial planning. Nothing too earth-shattering in here. It's really just getting people to think about their money in a very straightforward sense. Another book that Ian had mentioned is Dr. Moira Summers' Advice That Sticks. This is a fairly new book, and I've been flogging this one heavily myself. Advice That Sticks is actually written by a psychotherapist, if I remember right. I believe Moira is a psychotherapist. And she writes in this book about why clients don't take advice that they're given, and what an advisor can do to encourage clients to take advice. It's really a fantastic read, full of implementable, actionable items. It's a short read, just a couple hundred pages, and well worth reading. If you're in Canada, incidentally, and you're looking for a speaker for an event, you'll see Dr. Summers making the rounds here, and she's quite good. Daryl Diamond's book, Your Retirement Income Blueprint. This is a good book, too. It does something that I don't see a lot of other books do. What's happened here is Daryl, and it's funny, there's actually a Winnipeg connection here. Daryl and Moira are both in Winnipeg. But Daryl's book, he actually focuses in just on that one area of financial planning. He really does focus very much on how to manage your retirement income. And it's a Canadian book. It's quite good. He covers a broad range of topics or a broad range of items to consider, but it is that specific focus on retirement income. Quite good. And the other book that Ian had mentioned in there was by Dr. Daniel Crosby. And those of you that follow me on social media, you'll see from time to time I post these videos that come from one of the American Financial Services news outlets called On Your Best Behavior. Those are Daniel Crosby's books. You might remember him. He's a young guy, sort of looks like a professor. And he has a book called Laws of Wealth, which is fairly well known. Again, it takes some behavioral finance stuff and translates that into sort of practical lessons. It's probably the best behavioral finance book for financial advisors to read, just because it's the one that actually takes a lot of those sort of big hypothetical concepts and turns them into actionable items, things that a financial advisor will actually have seen sitting across the table from a client. A bunch of other books you might pick up. And the question here is, if you're going to read a book, is it, you know, just personal interest? Are you looking to broaden your horizons? Is it to learn a specific topic? And there's lots out there, tons and tons of stuff out there. So if you're looking to sort of broaden your horizons, I know that an area that's getting a lot of focus today is the area of behavioral finance. And if you're in for a hefty read, you might look at Daniel Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow. It is sort of the original book of behavioral finance. It's quite an intensive book, and it is worth the read. The criticism I have of it, it's quite long, and that's okay, but it's sometimes hard to see where the stuff that he talks about turns into practical application. He's an academic, and you can really see that there. That being said, it is the book on behavioral finance. It covers everything. Dan Ariely's behavioral finance books are a little bit more accessible, and he's kind of a fun behavioral finance writer. A lot of his experiments revolve around college students and beer, so you can kind of see the theme there. Predictably Irrational is the one that probably was his first big sort of commercial success. Dollars and Cents is a more recent release of Dan's. And then a very well-known book, this is actually the second book on the list by a Nobel Prize winner, Dan Kahneman having won a Nobel Prize as well, and that's Richard Thaler and Cass Sunstein wrote a book called Nudge. And this book is very much about encouraging positive behaviors that don't cause the person exhibiting those behaviors a lot of pain. A lot of this book is about public policy, but there are some things in here that I would suggest the sort of alert financial advisor might be able to bring into play with their clients. If you're looking for non-behavioral finance books, I'll pick on Moshe Malevsky and Aaron Gottesman's book, Insurance Logic. I don't find that many people writing about insurance today. It doesn't seem to be that popular a topic. But, of course, Moshe Malevsky has a love for insurance. Maybe that's the right way to put that. And it shows up in this book. It's a nice, tight little read. If you're looking for a book about financial planning businesses in Canada, I find this is an area where there's not enough written. What does an actual financial planning or financial advisory practice look like? I'll pick on John DeGooey's book here, The Professional Financial Advisor. It's quite good in the sense that it actually does lay out a bunch of different business models that a financial advisor might employ and the licensing that goes along with that and so forth. It's not written with that intention in mind. You'll see if you read the book that John very much has an agenda with writing this book. He wants clients to get, I think, what he would consider the best possible financial advice. And then you can go back to the classics here. You can go to David Chilton's Wealthy Barber, which is recently released. I know Your Money or Your Life was recently re-released. The Pig and the Python is an old Canadian classic here that really deals with how people plan for the long term. And it's good. It's a nice book because it has this real sort of storytelling aspect to it. If you're interested in reading what your clients are reading on money, it might be worth picking up. I know it's a little bit dated now, but I certainly still see them on bestseller shelves on the nonfiction side at airport bookstands and that kind of thing. And that's Gail Vaz Oxlade, of course, a Canadian common sense financial advice voice. And Gail's book, Money Rules, for example, is a nice book that you could even maybe buy and give to a client. It has a lot of little, just essentially aphorisms in it. How do you approach a particular issue, or almost like daily reads here? And of course, a lot of people recently have read the Tony Robbins book, Money, Master the Game. It might be one you pick up if you want to read what your clients are reading. And I would suggest that at the least give it a read to see what he has to say about financial advisors. That will maybe give you a little bit of ammunition if those questions ever come up. So lots and lots of reading that can be done out there. And certainly I'm interested to hear what other people are reading or what you find interesting that way. The number for today's episode is 11. The number is 11. You'll be able to get your continuing education credits by going to bccquiz.online. That's BCC as in Business Career College. bccquiz.online. And there's a little quiz you'll do there, just a few questions. And if you're already a subscriber, then it will issue you a certificate. If you're not already a subscriber, then you will have to sign up, and you'll be able to sign up there, and you'll be able to get your continuing education credits that way. Thanks very much for joining us today. Please do join us again in 2 weeks when we're going to be joined by Marshall and Kent from today's episode. We're going to delve into the Canada Pension Plan there. We're going to dig into Canada Pension Plan to a fair bit of detail and maybe help to make better decisions about what the right time to take the Canada Pension Plan retirement benefit is.